John chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. If you just joined us, I said a little earlier that we're going to be flipping around to the other three references as well in Matthew and Mark and Luke. But in John chapter 19, starting with verse 25, the text says, "These things therefore the soldiers did. But there were standing by the cross of Jesus, his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour the disciple took her unto his own home." We've talked about the fact that there were a number of people who were at the cross who were hostile to Jesus, and that's absolutely right. But one of the things that we may not emphasize too often is that there were also some people at the cross who were not really opposed to Jesus, and that's what you see here. There were at least a few who were standing, ongoing action. They were standing by the cross of Christ. Included in this number was at least three women, maybe four women, depending on how you count the ladies. If John described four women, they would have been Mary, the mother of Jesus. Second one would have been Mary's sister. That would be, they think, Salome, the mother of James and John. Mary, the wife of Clopas, nothing more is known about her. And Mary Magdalene, the lady who had previously been possessed by seven demons, and Jesus cast those out of her. But only John mentions the mother of Jesus, Mary, as being at the cross. So we've got some women there as well. One source made this point, and I like the comment. He said, "Of all the people who will be with you no matter what, that's going to be mom. Friends like Peter may deny and scatter, but good mothers will always be there. Jesus could not abort his cross. Mary could not abandon her son. She did not fully understand what he was doing, where things were headed, but she was at the foot of the cross." And I like that. Now, that's not true for every single mom, but there are a number of mothers who have stood by their children through thick and thin. They might have felt like dad gave up on them. Aunt and uncle, brother, sister, everybody abandoned them, but mom was still ready to be there through thick and thin. And I think that really speaks well of mothers. Anything that you want to interest before we move down and make a few more points? Okay. John, as you look at verse 26 from John chapter 19, you find that Jesus saw his mother along with the disciple whom he loved. Who do you think this disciple is that Jesus loved? John. Do you think the Lord loved the other disciples as well?
Yes.
All right. We would, I think, all be in agreement on that point. Why then word it this way? Well, who's writing this book?
John.
And where do we find the disciple whom Jesus loved? It's in the book of John. So if you're having to describe some information about yourself and you don't want to put yourself out there as far as being on a big pedestal, how might you describe yourself? In the way that John did. So he may have had other reasons for describing himself in this manner, but we, when we read that, need to realize that John's probably describing himself. And then Jesus. You seem to have him in some special circumstances where, yes, he had an especially close relationship with Jesus. And rather than try to make anything out of that as he writes the book, it seems like this is a way to indicate humility on his part, that he was not trying to use that in some special way. Okay, a couple of quick points here. How does Jesus address Mary? Looks at her and says, "Woman, behold thy son." Why do you think he said that?
Wait, the woman part or the behold thy son?
Well, you can take both or just one. I'll supplement that a little bit. Remember back there in John chapter 2, what's going on? Jesus is at a wedding, and he uses the same wording, "Woman, behold thy son." Why do that? Really at the beginning of his ministry, now at the end. "Woman, behold thy son." Well, if you have language that, well, get to you in just a second, language, Ray. If you have language that's being used that sounds pretty bold or striking, generally one of two things will be true. It could be language which is designed to indicate what? I'm speaking to you in a positive way, or I'm speaking to you in a negative way. This language would seem to fall into one of those two categories. Would you say it is positive or negative? All right. I agree. Ray, we'll take your thought.
What I think when I read that is he's reminding her both times that where he come from.
Yes.
And that he is the Son of God. And I think that's what he's getting here. You don't have to worry about me and where I'm going. And in the other one, remember where I came from.
All those motherly inclinations, I need to take care of my son and so forth. Jesus says, look, this is heaven's plan. I'm doing the will of God. Watch. Anybody else want to toss out something there? Dolores?
I was just scratching my little bit. I'm thinking.
All right.
You know, Jesus was also saying to her, you know, at the wedding feast, it was like, you're bothering me with these trivial little things, but I'll take care of it. Here, it's like he's saying, don't worry about it. I'm not leaving you alone. You know, here's John. He's going to take good care of you for
me. And you really begin to see that in verse 27. It's, I'm here. I'm on this mission. There's some things that I need to do that you can't help with, but there's someone who can help you. Someone's going to need to very likely look after you, and that's going to be John. I trust him, so I'm giving him a charge from the cross to ensure that he's going to take care of you for all the years or all the days that you have left. I think that's it. That's exactly right. All right, so you have here an opportunity for Jesus to deal with two very important people in his life, and they can be together to comfort one another after Jesus dies. When you study Jesus' sayings on the cross, here's one of the things that you find that you might not normally think about. They sort of get narrower and narrower in scope. For example, what do we have Jesus praying for early? Father, do what? Father, forgive who? Them. We talked about the them way back when. The them, we don't know exactly who that refers to. Could it be the soldiers? Sure. Could it be the Jews? Sure. Could it be all of them? Yes, but forgive them. And then Jesus narrows that down a little bit. He goes from forgiving them to this conversation with who? We talked about him at the beginning of class. Now he's focused on the? All right, especially the robber, that single one. And then now he's giving some instructions about Mary. Then a little later, who's he focused on? Himself. So it's very interesting that you find that Jesus starts out with sort of a broad brush and he doesn't have a lot of time, but he narrows that scope very, very quickly. All right, no information is given about Jesus' half-brothers and sisters. They could have at this time still been in the area of Galilee. We do know John 7 and verse 5, there was a time, a long time, where they did not believe on him. Joseph is not mentioned. I think that most of us are familiar with that fact. Probably not mentioned for what reason? All right, I think he's probably died by this point. Was it a natural death? Was it an accident? We don't know. But if John's going to take care of Mary and there's no reference to Joseph here, it would seem to me that he's already passed on for some reason. There's also very little information about the apostles at this time with the exception of John. And I think there's a reason for that. Back in the book of Zechariah, chapter 13 and verse 7, and you see this from Matthew 26 and verse 56 as well, what has happened, it seems like, to the apostles? Jesus is on the cross, and where did his special friends go?
No one's around except John.
Yeah, they split. It's interesting, though, that you've got some women that seem to be hanging around. Now, maybe they felt like they were going to be threatened less, or maybe they had more courage on this occasion than the men. We don't know exactly why they were more willing to stay than the guys, but that speaks well of them and maybe not so well for the rest of the apostles. But you wonder about some people like Mary, Martha, Lazarus, where were they? One of the other people that I wonder about. Jesus, Pilate, and who's that other character that shows up on the scene before we get to the cross? Herod, Pilate, Jesus, Barabbas. He's freed, right? He gets his presidential pardon, so to speak. I might wonder, if I were Barabbas, who's this guy? What's happening at the cross of Jesus? Be interesting to know if Barabbas decided to go visit the cross that day. It might be that he decided to get out while the getting was good, that nobody would revoke his papers. But I think some people would be curious enough, maybe at a distance, but they would be curious enough to see who this, I mean, he knew what he'd done. The people knew that he was guilty. There was no question that he had been a really bad guy. It would be like, you know, a guy today being freed from death row, and they said somebody else is going to be put in the chair. Some people would be curious. I want to see what happens to that guy, because you know, there's been a replacement here, and I'm the one who's getting off scot-free, so to speak. So he might have headed out of town, but it's very interesting to consider that he still might have hung around. Trace?
What about Jesus' siblings?
Again, John 7:5, they didn't believe on him. Could they have been around the cross? Could they have been hoping for information? No information is given. And again, we're curious about where they are, what they're thinking at this time. Yeah. But it's a good question.
Does it have to be because he's the oldest and has the responsibility since Joseph is dead?
It could be. We don't know exactly how wealthy Jesus' brothers were. Seems like the Lord was from a poor family. John, he has the fishing business, so he might have had more resources and been in a better position, at least for a while, to care for Mary. That may not be a complete answer, but that might at least help us a little bit in that respect. Carol?
If none of his brothers were around.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true too.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's see where we want to pick up from here. Did John wait very long to take Mary away?
No.
All right, so that tells us that he did not wait very long. He takes her to his home just as Jesus had instructed. And some think that John was permanently responsible for Mary. I don't know that you can prove that conclusion. I mean, that's certainly possible. If that were necessary, again, I don't see any difficulty with it, but you might find that Jesus' half-brothers and half-sisters began to care for Mary at a later time. There is a tradition, and traditions are only that. There is no way to say that they are true or false, but there is a tradition which says Mary lived with John in Judea until the time of her death. That was 15 years after this time, but again, no way to establish that for sure. Let me give you this other quick point, and then we'll slip over to Matthew 27. Knowing that Jesus' mother was at the cross is pretty significant for a couple of reasons. Can anybody guess a reason or two why that's true? Why was it important that Mary was at the cross? Important in some respects, even for us.
She became a personal witness.
Okay, that's putting us on the right road, but let's see if we can add some meat to those bones.
We could imagine if there had been someone close to Jesus who would testify that this really is my son who's on the cross.
Okay. If all the charges against Jesus were a lie, who of all people would have wanted to speak out?
Yeah.
Mom, right? All the stuff that's been said about my son, none of that's true. He's not the son of God. He's not special. But what would have prevented her from doing that?
She was.
Way back when. Remember, the angel shows up? And she'd been carrying around all those things in her heart for all those years? Could Mary have made some claims about her son being delusional? Moms do that today, don't they? A son, or maybe a daughter, but usually it's a son. A son really goes off the rails and does something violent, and mom shows up and says, he's not in his right mind. We tried to get counseling. He's never been of the right mind. His thinking is not correct. And I want you to know that he's crazy. But there's no indication at all that she ever sought to deny the Lord's claims in any sense. So by standing by and by not trying to stop the execution, Mary was either one of the most evil mothers that has ever existed, or what's the second option? Yeah, she really believed the angel that came to her many years before, Luke chapter 1 and Luke chapter 2 and verse 35. So remember, the angel talked about there's going to be the sword that goes through your heart. Well, she may have had that experience on various occasions, but now it's being plunged all the way through. And she still surely didn't understand everything that was involved, but little by little, it's becoming clear. And she knows that she's got to stand by and let all this unfold. Anything that you want to add or ask over John 19? Okay, let's flip over to the first account of Jesus' life. This is going to be Matthew 27. And we want Matthew chapter 27. We'll start with verse 45. Jesus is on the cross. Matthew 27 and 45. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. Jesus was crucified at the third hour. Mark confirms that as well, Mark 15 and verse 25, and the third hour would have been about what time? All right, 9 a.m. And as you look at the events that took place, everything seems to have been fairly ordinary until we get to the sixth hour. That, of course, would have been about noon. John, if you look at his account, that's in John chapter 19 and verse 14, he says that Jesus appeared before Pilate at the sixth hour. Well, now, if you're reading that and you would say, okay, wait, John says the sixth hour, and that doesn't line up very well with the other accounts. How would you reconcile that information? Okay, I think we're dealing, when we look at John, we're dealing with Roman time instead of Jewish time, and that would help us in that respect. So you've got about noon, Matthew 27 and verse 45, Mark 15 and verse 33, Luke chapter 23 and verse 44. Darkness comes over the whole land, and how long does it last? It lasts until, all right, 3 p.m., that would be the ninth hour. Uninspired writers have called this darkness, which took place at the brightest and hottest point during the day, midnight at noonday. And I think that's a pretty good description for it. When you look at Luke chapter 23 and verse 45, you have there the sun being replaced with darkness instead of clouds. And people, just like any other miracle in the Bible, they'll look at the information and say, oh no, that's not a miracle. That was not something that was done by God. In this case, how do you think that they tried to excuse or explain the darkness?
It was an eclipse.
All right, they would say it was an eclipse. It was a natural phenomena. Well, that doesn't fit for a couple of reasons. It just, you know, happens to be during the exact time, the high point of Jesus' crucifixion. It's also during this time that the Lord is crying out with a loud voice. I'll put in a cross-reference here, back in the book of Amos. Amos chapter 8 and verse 9. Darkness is used to describe a lot of things in Scripture, and I think this cross-reference is helpful. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord Jehovah, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day. That's really what you have. Now, that wasn't a prophecy pointing to the crucifixion of Christ, but it was a way of saying God was indicating that he was unhappy with his people, that great devastation, great destruction was going to come, and here you have God indicating his wrath, his unhappiness. What would you think that the darkness represents? Matthew 27 and verse 45.
Sin.
All right. I think sin, God's wrath against sin, that would be another aspect of that. The darkness covers the whole land. That would be Matthew 27 and verse 45. You might find, if you have the King James translation in Luke's account of this, the New King James as well, in Luke 23 and verse 44, it says it covered the entire earth or the whole earth. Question. What do you think we should walk away with as far as an understanding? The land, the area of Palestine, or God just covered every place on the earth with darkness?
He was dying for everybody on the whole earth.
So you'd opt for the whole earth?
Yeah.
Maybe, yes, no? What do you think?
You know, I would think probably just that particular area. The reason I would say that, we've seen how God worked in the land of Goshen, when he had plagues that came on the Egyptians and it didn't affect the Israelites. So they're well aware of what happened there. But my thoughts on it, that it just happened more of a local area.
Okay, so we've got one and one. Anybody want to break the tie?
I'm not going to break the tie, but some places would have already been dark. It would have been nighttime somewhere on the earth, right?
Yeah. Well, that might break the tie. Anybody else want to contribute? I side with Ray in part because of what happened in Egypt, but also in our study in Exodus. When you look at what we're looking at on Sunday evenings back in Exodus chapter 19, you have God saying, look, I'm going to come down on the mountain and you're going to have all these signs. The whole earth is not shaking and quaking. This was a local phenomena. And I can't prove it with 100% certainty, but it seems to me that this is the same kind of thing that you have when it comes to Jesus and the earth being darkened. It was for these people. The gospel first went to the Jews. That was God's plan. So in that local area of Palestine, that's, in my estimation, what we're dealing with there. But again, I can't prove that with absolute certainty. Anybody else want to make a comment on that?
Not really the whole land, just this part of the whole land. So I tend to
Well, let's take an example. Let's look at the book of Luke for a second. Let's go back and take a look at the census. Let's start with Luke 2. Now it came to pass in those days there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that how many should be enrolled?
All the world.
Now would we understand that to be North America? Well, okay. So there, again, you're dealing with language which would have been understood by those people as far as the known world at that time. So, again, that may not be appropriate for every single passage, but at least you do have one example of there being all the world, and most would say we don't think that it applied to all the world. But that always is a consideration. If a language says it, if you're going to set that aside, you need to have a pretty good reason for it. We do the same thing sometimes when we talk about people. Everybody does that.
Right.
Well, you know, everybody uses a computer mouse. Well, what about the guy over in Timbuktu that's never seen a computer? He's obviously not using a computer mouse if he doesn't have a computer. So sometimes language is accommodative, and it's something that we need to look carefully at as far as are we actually including every single person, every single place, or not. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But good thought. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back and see how sin has affected humanity in at least five ways. I would suggest that sin has affected us physically. When we think about being physically affected by sin, we see that through evil, we see that through disease, we also see that through death. We have been affected by sin in a geophysically sense. That is, Stan and I were talking about this the other day. If you could go back and see the earth prior to the flood, I believe it still would have been round. Stan still believes it would have been round. But there would have been stuff that was a lot different back then compared to what you see now. There were just huge upheavals because of the flood. Sin has resulted in some cultural changes. You think about, for example, the multiple languages, significant cultural changes. Man has been affected by it in a psychological way. We now suffer from issues like guilt. And we've also been created by God in a perfect state, but sin has created a spiritual problem for us. So sin is a big, big issue, and the other four issues are also problems, and maybe that's one more reason why God allowed this darkness to cover the land, whether you understand that to be the whole earth or whether you understand that to be a smaller area. All right, let me show you this too. Matthew 27:45 and Mark 15, verse 34. Who wants to pick up for us Mark 15, 34? Brian, you want to do that? Mark chapter 15, verse 34. And we want to see how Mark 15, 34 differs from Matthew 27, verse 45. Maybe you've noticed this before. Maybe you've not noticed this before, but there is a difference.
And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Okay. Did you hear anything there? That's different than what you find in Matthew 27 and verse 45. All right, look at Matthew 27, 45. And I'm going to let Brian read again. Mark chapter 15, verse 34.
And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi.
Stop. Say those two words again.
Eloi.
Yeah.
Eloi.
Is that different than what you have?
That says Eli.
Yeah. You think they got the typing wrong? Eli in Matthew 27 and verse 45, Eloi in Mark chapter 15 and verse 34. Different wording. So if you've never noticed that before, here's the reason why. Matthew, from what we can tell, was using the Hebrew language to express those words. Mark used Aramaic. So you might have in the past been familiar with one and just never realized that you also have Maybe you were familiar with the Aramaic and used Mark's account. Maybe you were familiar with Matthew and never thought about Mark's account. But being a careful reader, you can pick up those kinds of things. All right, anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Matthew 27:46? Okay, thank you, Brian. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" One of the interesting things about Jesus is the fact that when he was on the earth, the Lord asked a lot of questions. There was some guy who probably had a little too much time in his hands. He went back and tried to count up all the number of times you had Jesus asking questions in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This fellow, if his count is right, he came up with 307 questions asked by Jesus. Now, that's a bunch. So when you start reading through the life of Christ and you see a question asked by Jesus, you can just, like I say, add probably 300 plus more to them because he asked all kinds of questions. Some he answered, some he didn't. Some of the questions were obvious as far as the answers. Some of the answers were not so obvious. So you have here about the ninth hour, 3 p.m., Jesus speaking with a loud voice. And what does he ask the Father? My God, why have you forsaken me? Now, this gets interesting for a couple of reasons. Some believe that the Jews sacrificed the Passover lambs about 3 p.m. If that's true, the Jews were accustomed, they were in the habit of sacrificing the Passover lambs at 3 p.m., then Jesus, as he asked this question at that time, you can see one more way that the providence of God is working in conjunction with the Old Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7 says that Christ is our, anybody remember? Passover. Jesus is our Passover. So maybe as the lambs were being slain, Jesus was also at the throes of death at that time. We do know from what John said in the book of John, John 1:29 and John 1:36, John said, "Behold, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world," and that was exactly right. Now, the question about Jesus being forsaken by the Father, this is considered to be his foreseeing from the cross, and that is not recorded by Luke. It's also not recorded by John. As people heard that statement, they may have immediately thought of Psalm 22 and verse 1. That's how that psalm begins, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? For us, when we think about being forsaken or forsaking someone or something, what comes to mind? Somebody says, you need to forsake that sin. All right, turn your back, leave it alone, abandon it, cut yourself off from it, have no contact with it. Could forsake have another reading, another meaning though? Could forsake have a second meaning? Well, let me frame the question a little differently. That first sense that we gave, Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Could it be, as some have thought, that God just looks away and says, I'm not going to look on you because of what's taking place right now? Could forsake be used in that sense? Yes. Could there be a second sense in which forsake might be used in relation to Jesus? What if God continued to look but didn't help? Could the word forsake be used in that sense? Guy out there drowning, and you forsook me. You stayed on the bank, and you watched me. You didn't help, but you didn't actually get in your car and leave. Well, let's take a look at some passages. Let's go back to the book of Isaiah. You have a little time to get there. Isaiah 53, we'll look at verse 11. Isaiah 53, 11. Who wants that one? All right, Betty? Then let's go over to Psalm 22, and we'll take a look at about four verses there. Psalm 22, verse 19, and then we'll look at verses 20 and 21, and then also verse 24. Who wants to be our Psalm 22 reader? All right, Julie. Let's start with Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 11. Let's read the first part of that verse once more.
He shall see
of the travail of his soul.
Okay. The travail of his soul, and what's associated with that? You're going to
be satisfied.
Well, not only that, but you're going to see it. That's interesting. That to me sounds like the Father's looking on. Then let's pick up some information from Psalm 22. Let's start with verse 19.
But be not thou far from me, O Lord, O my strength, haste thee to help me.
Okay, be not far, that's a desire. Then 20 and 21.
Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorns.
Okay, again, as you look through Psalm 22, it relates directly to what you have as far as Jesus on the cross. So he's going to see him, Isaiah 53 and verse 11. Now Psalm 22, by the time you get down to verse 21, it sounds like he's still looking on him. And then what do you find in verse 24?
For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried unto him, he heard.
Okay. Did he hide his face? He didn't. Did he hear? Yes. So as I look at those passages, I have to ask the question, when Jesus says, why have you forsaken me? Does that mean that you have, you know, gone off and you're not looking? Or does that mean that you are still there, but you are not going to interfere? People have sometimes some strong ideas about this, so I try to give the evidence and people can make their own minds up as far as making some judgments. But let's consider some things beyond what we just looked at. Sometimes a person says, God can't look on sin. Well, that sounds really good. But would you say that's true?
He sees everything. He sees him all the time.
Yeah. And you remember that little story in Genesis chapter 18? You've got the people, the visitors come down from heaven. And it's in relation to Sodom and Gomorrah. And they say, let's go and do what? Let's go look. Let's go see. Well, what do you think they're going to see?
Sin.
They're going to see sin. Now, don't you think that they knew before they came down?
Yes.
Yes. But that's a way of saying we're going to go and check things out. And you have passages like Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 13. Others would say, well, look, God can't have any fellowship with sin. That's also true. But having fellowship with sin is not the same as simply knowing what is going on. And then you have this. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 46, Jesus said to the Father, I want you to do what? I want you to receive my spirit or soul. Does it sound like communication is taking place there? Yes. So somebody might want to argue, well, the window was just kind of shut for a little while from heaven. So when you think about when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? I understand that as being just like you find in Psalm 22 and verse 19, that the Father stood by, and when that cry went out, the Father was going to let him suffer in the ways that we have talked about. Thayer, someone who defines original words, Greek words, concurred with this conclusion when he defined forsaken as leave in straits, leave helpless, leave in a lurch. And as Marcia mentioned, God is always in all places at all times. And if that's true, then when we think about Jesus on the cross, he was still there but did not interfere. But again, you're going to find some people who have some different views, and that's fine. But that is my take on Jesus being forsaken. Dolores? Sure. You see that, I think, in the garden.
Right.
You know, if there's some other way.
Right.
But, you know, I could have called the angels, But again, everything has been just kind of put on hold because this is the way that it has to be. And I'm going to be forsaken in the sense that I suggested, and that is no help is going to come. I'm going to have to see this through, and no other special assistance. Anybody else? Betty, and then Brian will take your hand.
He knew he has to because that's why he sent him into the world. And why bring him to this point? Go through all that he's gone through and bring him to this point. And then say, no, I'm going to save you now?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, that would be cruelty on top of cruelty.
Yeah. Well, when you think about certain training programs, for example, a final test. If you look at it in terms of a military test as an example, you're going to become a SEAL. You know, they're not going to let you drown. I mean, they're going to be out there watching, but at the same time, they're not going to help. If you're going to pass the course, you're going to have to get through the water, you're going to have to make your way through the bullets, whatever that might be. I mean, if you get shot as you're going through the barbed wire and they're shooting live rounds across you, I mean, they're going to pull you out and they're going to patch you up and so forth. But they're not going to stop the bullets so that you can get through that course easier than somebody else on the team.
Yeah, and God knew that once he was through this, he'd be back in heaven.
Yeah.
He'd have him back with him.
Yeah.
So but why stop it?
You are going to have to go through this on your own.
Oh.
Brian?
Another completely different understanding of the statement of Jesus here, read in a sermon, it was that Jesus was not expressing his feeling at all, and that instead he was trying to bring to memory all these Jews who were standing around him by saying that first verse of Psalm 22, he's sort of getting them to think of everything that that psalm says and think about what's happening here. And just so, because we think about from the time of the arrest all the way through this point, Jews very familiar with the Old Testament ought to recognize things that are going on as fulfillment of prophecy. And maybe Jesus was just pointing them back, trying to get them to think about what's going on.
There are some who would take that even a step further, and they think that Jesus quoted the whole 22nd Psalm. Now, whether or not the Lord actually did that, we can't know. But he certainly does make at least one allusion to it, maybe multiple appeals. To, again, the 23rd Psalm is very, very common to us. Surely it was common to the people, and it's tied with Psalm 22 and 24. So these were surely three psalms that the Jews were very, very familiar with. And as Jesus goes back to that 22nd Psalm, it should have gotten the attention of people.
And then the thief on the cross, it's like, see, I can still forgive people. It's still me that's forgiving people, just like I can forgive you. And then in the end, he says, it's finished. You know, I've done all I can do. I'm going on with the Father.
And then too, when he says, I thirst, it says of that phrase that he said that so that the scriptures might be fulfilled.
Yeah.
So again, he keeps going back to fulfilling the scripture and demonstrating it.
Yeah, and the behavior is amazing. And I think that's why you have to look at the centurion. He had surely seen a lot of crucifixions, and he says, truly, this was the Son of God. When you see a lot of people today, whether it is in a death chamber or you have somebody who's being punished, you generally don't find people who use good language and they're quoting the Bible. When somebody's being put to death, when the needle comes, what do you find? Well, okay, they're going to be fighting, they're going to be struggling, you see that. What kind of language do you expect? Why you? And you get all the four-letter words and, you know, may you burn in hell. And I mean, they just go on a rant, don't they? A lot of times. But what do you have Jesus? He's praying for his enemies. It's a very impassioned death, but also it is a very restrained death as far as what he's gone through. And if you were there, you had to be thinking, if you had any sense at all, who was this guy?
There had to be something totally different about that one crucifixion.
Yeah.
For this hardened soldier.
Yeah.
That.
And then you got the darkness showing up at noonday, and it's kind of like, you know, I'm not a complete fool. You know, this guy, maybe he'd heard some things about Jesus, and when the darkness comes and he sees the way that he dies and so forth, reaching out to the other thief, it's kind of like, we're in trouble. Anybody else? All right, Lord willing, we will pick up with Matthew 27, verses 47 to 49 next week. Thank you.